You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
It's good to be back.
It is good to, it's good to have you back,
yeah.
You know, we're honored, really.
Well, you know, part of being, I read in Adam Grant's book, and we're going to have him on, in originals, they say that people who create original work create a whole bunch of work,
mm-hmm.
a whole bunch of work. And of that work, you know, something like, I don't know how many, you know, pieces Beethoven and Mozart and those guys create, and Picasso was never, he never stopped. He made mm-hmm. something like 12,000 sculptures and 40,000 paintings. And among all that, there was a lot of junk.
Yep.
There's a lot of, you know, it's a process.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it's also like how many times you roll the dice, right? If you,
yeah.
if you do 40,000 things, you know, then.
But then you get busy. Like, so with me doing these two TV shows, Kingdom and the Goldbergs, then I have this series on, which started as a web series on Fox, but I don't know if it's going to be a web series now. They're talking about it being something else, but it's still so much work. Oh,
yeah.
And then I got two kids and a wife. Oh, and then I got the live podcast tour. Oh, and then I got my stand-up. It just gets, you don't want to spread too thin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, I'm doing the other podcast. The problem is you wonder how effective you're being at any one thing. It keeps
yeah.
you on the straight and narrow. At least I don't stray. At least I don't have time for my Coke binges. I don't do Coke, but if I did, I was trying to come with something funny. I don't really have any vices besides good wine.
But I kind of like that idea, you know, like, you know, I'm so busy, I want to make more time for Coke this year. Like,
yeah.
that's a good New Year's
resolution. I want to make more time. My priorities are boxing and tennis. I don't have any time for that anymore.
Oh, Brian.
I know.
But, you know, I mean, that's the thing. You got to work those things back into your life. Like, you know.
It's so important.
It is so important.
I'm going to box today.
Yeah.
I'm squeezing it in.
You should. You should make it a priority,
oh,
you know?
Yeah.
But then
oh,
you
yeah.
got to figure out how to make that more a part of your life. I mean, presumably with the fighter and the kid, like, if you're doing these live video experiences, you know, why not have one of them be where Brendan is teaching you to, like, you know, grapple or,
well, we
you
just,
know.
We're writing something like that.
So
right
then
now.
There you go.
Get
there you go.
Here.
Work it in.
Brendan gives me a training camp because I have to confront my bully, Will Sasso.
Oh, Jesus. Will yeah. Sasso is definitely a bully, by the way.
He's a big bully.
He's a big bully.
He calls me up and he goes, hey, I'm coming over. Cook me a meal. I'm like, but I'm not in town. He goes, well, be in town. He's so funny. Will Sasso is the funniest person on the planet.
Funnier
Hunter,
than
teach
you?
Me, teach me some things. You've been,
well,
reading, you've been reading a lot.
I have been reading a lot. And, you know, you've been, I should update you on some of the things that
give me an update on what I've missed.
Yeah, I'm going
to
give
and
you
And I
the...
want to apologize to all our fans that I've been remiss, but I will be back, and I am back.
Yeah. So I think we've had a lot of interesting stuff, but I think the sort of the big highlight is, you know, Richard Nisbett and Joe Henrich, right? So, you know, Joe Henrich wrote a book called The Secret of Our Success. Now, Brian, if you give an IQ test to an orangutan, a chimpanzee, and a toddler, what do you think you find?
An IQ test to an orangutan, a chimpanzee, and
a
toddler.
Human toddler, yeah.
I think it comes out, my guess would be it all comes out equal.
That's right, except for there's one big difference. Where do you think that you can guess that the human toddler is smarter in one area. What area do you think that is?
Probably in, how do you, I mean, well, an IQ test. I'm not sure what is on the test.
Well, you can measure different types of IQ, right?
Right.
You can have, like, you know, analytical.
Human beings are better at using tools, I would imagine.
No. Nope.
No. Pattern recognition?
No, social intelligence.
Oh,
so
really?
The thing, exactly.
Well, chimps are social, though.
They are.
Orangutans are actually solitary creatures as they get older.
But humans are hypersocial, right?
Right.
We can form social structures that are so complex that they have millions, billions of people in them, right?
Yeah.
We can shift off. We can break into groups. We can say, this person's an asshole, right? Like, so we separate out from them and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And the point of Henrich's book is that it's not that chimps don't have culture. They do. They have tools, right?
Yeah.
They do things like fish for termites and, you know, they wash their potatoes and all of that sort of stuff. But what chimps can't do is accumulate culture. So they can't build culture from generation to generation to generation to generation. And humans can accumulate culture, right? So that we can build
on... So chimps have been the same ever since, and humans continue to change.
Yeah. It continues to change because we continue to accumulate more and more complex culture. So what emerges from this is, I mean, that is like such... The consequences of that are so huge and so mind-blowing that it's really hard to capture. But I think that's a good topic for us to talk about in this, you know, this little podcast. Because you then get that basically, you know, the intelligence of human beings is not that anyone is particularly smart, but that there is an emergent intelligence that comes from us being social
sharing
creatures.
Sharing of ideas.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so if, you know, if you then look back at, say, Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, through that lens, you then see that the reason why the Egyptians did such amazing things, or the Aztecs, or all these sorts of different cultures,
because they had access to other ideas, other cultures, right? And they could
They had food that allowed them to grow large populations with huge densities. So suddenly, you know, the hive mind is bigger, right? Yep. Like if you've got a few scattered farmers, you know, or herders, you know, on some sort of hillside in Albania, well, that's one thing. But when you have something like the River Nile, suddenly you can build up these massive population densities. Or if you have corn, right, near the Aztecs, you can build up these massive population densities. So now your hive mind is much, much bigger than the hive mind of a few scattered Albanian farmers, right? But that only covers you, that only brings you a certain distance, right? Because that's not the entirety of the story. It's not just, oh, the countries with the biggest populations are the most innovative or whatever else it is. You have to look at what those individuals are doing. And that's where Darren Acemoglu's book becomes super important, right, with James Robinson, because it's then how inclusive are those societies. You can have a country like North Korea that has millions of people, but in practice, it's not really two heads are better than one. You have a tiny number of heads, and the majority of people don't really participate.
Right.
Or you can have something like Peru, right? Hernando de Soto writes The Other Path, and you find that, oh, you have a small number of elites who are making all the decisions, and the majority of people can't really participate in the economy. And so I think that together starts to, you know, create a vision and a view of history that is fundamentally radically different, because it really is, the whole of history is about the wisdom of crowds.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, also, you know, they did a, and Adam Grant said in his book, they looked at Nobel Prize winning scientists, and scientists of the same merit who were steeped in the same disciplines and were obviously worked as hard. So the ones that didn't win Nobel Prizes versus the ones that did win Nobel Prizes, the Nobel Prize winners were almost always, they had hobbies that had to do with the arts.
Yeah.
They were actors, they were poets, they were painters, they were writers.
And that's that cross-pollination. I mean,
they were exposed to these different ideas. Galileo, when he was looking at his telescope, wasn't really strong enough to see the ridges of the mountains on the moon, I think it was, or Mars, wherever, but he, because he was a painter, a draftsman, he knew that's what shadows looked like. And so he said, that's got to be mountains. That's going to be a raised surface.
I mean, I don't know if he talks about Newton, but like, I think it's in Walter Isaacson's biography of Newton. He talks about...
I read that.
Which, yeah, was really, really good. And part of the point is that Newton's alchemy was vital to his figuring out the theory of gravitation, because the very idea that two objects could affect each other without touching is, you know, weird to the sort of most of Newton's contemporaries. But to an alchemist, this was, you know, very normal.
Yeah.
You know, things mystically interfered with each other without touching all the time. And that's that. I mean, that sort of cross-pollination that you see happening between cultures obviously also happens within individual minds, where, you know, you have people like Newton or you have people like Galileo who benefit from different ideas that are being brought
together. I wonder, though, if that's, I mean, I would imagine that is the case with the internet. But damn,
but
there's a lot of information out there. That's
but I,
not...
I think that's the point, is that part of the consequence of that groupishness, that tribalism, that high social intelligence, is that these ideas do not necessarily cross-pollinate, right? And that's what we found.
Well, they do in a sense. Like, for example, I do think the internet in ways is making us more compassionate in terms, at least we're able to kind of get a sense of how similar we are to people, not how sure. different. It does break down the similar.
There's a process. The differences. There's a process, and the process is happening at whatever rate it's happening. But yeah. our whole experience with this podcast is that A, the best ideas are trapped in books, so they're not really moving out into the general public. Mm-hmm. And B, they're not necessarily moving between different fields. Like, there's not a whole lot of synthesis going on.
Although politicians are always citing books and citing think tanks and citing these points. They're bolstering their points of view with what?
Is it ideas? Yeah, but is it
an... Book writers.
Yeah, but is it an echo chamber, or is it that they're fundamentally reaching out across the aisle and trying to understand? And that's the point. I mean, there's a lot.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, what I was saying, I was having a conversation at dinner with some very smart, successful people. But man, they have very deep built-in prejudices when it comes to political thinking. They don't think about politics. They don't. They just have these general attitudes, and they're going to vote along those. They're going to vote along a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
A candidate's going to give them a feeling. Like, so, you know, Trump tells it like it is. Mm-hmm. I like that. And it's just refreshing, and they're going to vote for it.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the way you win an election. I guess maybe the founding fathers knew that, but...
Well, but I don't think, I mean, certainly we all, I mean, again, we have fast thinking and we have slow thinking, right? That's Kahneman's point. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we mostly rely on fast thinking, but we always have the option with our slow thinking to go in there and re-examine our assumptions. And that's the point is, you know, it's always easier to rely on your fast thinking than to go in there and question your assumptions and redo that. And the internet doesn't fundamentally solve that human tendency. Right. What it has the potential to do, and what Haidt and other people have found, is that it has the potential for people to just reinforce their own fast thinking. You know, you go and you believe what you want to believe.
It reinforces your own fast
thinking. That's right. And so, and which is, you know, that's a choice. But I think always, you know, humanity has not changed, you know, fundamentally that much in the last 100,000 years, right? We still have fear. We still have these prejudices. We still have these intuitions. Power still corrupts people's minds. You know, all of these sorts of things are still there woven into, you know, our hardwired programming, right? We mm-hmm. come preloaded with that stuff. And so there's this idea that, oh, the internet is going to solve all of our problems. But the internet is a tool and a technology. And like Michael says, it makes it easier for these books to transfer, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to go and have the mindset to want to go and reach outside of their comfort zone, question their own assumptions. Yeah. That's a cultural thing, and you have to make that. I mean, you and I grew up internationally.
You have to know how to do it too. I mean, that's the other thing. It's hard to know how to do it.
Right, and that you need to do it. I mean, that's the point. I think you and I grew up internationally. We moved from culture to culture. We've seen a lot of people with a lot of very different cultural assumptions. We know that, you know, your cultural assumptions reinforce themselves, and it's very easy to naively think, oh, this makes sense to me, so it must be true. But that doesn't mean that it's actually true. It just means that anything that makes sense to you is going to feel like it's true.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, you have to constantly be re-examining your own prejudices so that you can have more helpful prejudices.
That's the hardest thing about sort of educating yourself. A lot of times realizing that it's difficult to not sort of fall into that trap of reinforcing your own prejudices. Mm-hmm. It feels better. It feels safe. But I try to avoid that too. I mean, I do think that I will, when you try to arrive at a conclusion, it's better to kind of think in broad stroke philosophical terms. Really, what percentage of the government do you think should have power over what you do? I mean, there you can kind of draw those, have the discussion there. Start the discussion not on a left or right wing thing or on gun control or on different points of view, but rather, first of all, is government, meaning a central authority, is that the best way to make things better? We all know we want to solve a problem. We want to solve the same problem.
Right.
We don't like a world where people who can't take care of themselves are suffering.
Mm-hmm.
We want to stop people from suffering mm-hmm. needlessly, for example. And we all agree with that unless you're a maniac. And I think the debate comes down to people have different ideas of how to do that, right? So let's start that discussion there and try to be philosophical about how we approach it, because I think that's the way you can be the most fair. That's mm-hmm. the way you can really be the most compassionate to the issues. when you don't investigate, when you don't try to learn from other people's thinking and experience, really, i.e. books, or talking to smart people.
Or talking to, ordinary
points of
people.
Reading points of view that you don't agree with. I don't like Paul Krugman. I don't like him because he seems like an arrogant, smug Albert Tuohy from Ayn Rand. I think that's the book or the fountainhead. I mean, he just seems like he knows everything. And he is a guy who really does believe he's smarter than everybody and that he should be making decisions for us. I really think that's in his DNA. I don't like the guy. But I read his column because he knows things I don't know. And I do get something out of it. And sometimes I do find myself agreeing with him, or at least he opens my eyes to look in a certain direction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's also important.
Well, so, you know, one of the, so when we had Richard Nisbett on, Richard Nisbett is the guy who really led the charge against political correctness and started studying cultures again, right?
I love this. I don't know Nisbett. I need to get involved.
Well, so Malcolm Gladwell described Richard Nisbett as being responsible for his entire worldview.
What?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
God damn it.
And so
I missed this podcast.
You did miss this podcast. It was a good one.
Fuck.
But so Richard Nisbett was is a Texan, right? He grew up in Texas. And in the 90s, when political correctness was at his height, he was like, what culture can I study? And he said, well, if I'm going to critique a culture, then I should critique my own. And he said, as a white Southern man, you know, there are things that I know about the South that should change. And basically, he studied, you know, why is it that the South has higher homicide rates in the areas of lovers' triangles, trespassing, you know, all of these sorts of things. And he found it's basically because the South has a culture of honor, which they picked up from Scottish herdsmen, which is...
So this is Gladwell. This is what Gladwell...
Well, Gladwell wrote about it, but it's all Nisbett's work.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so that whole thing, and we had a whole conversation that you missed out on because, you know, you were doing whatever you were making crazy money supporting your cheese habit. But anyway, so and you know, you find that all of these herding cultures are incredibly macho, right? The Arabs are, you know, historically herders. You know, Latin Americans are historically herders.
Afghanis.
They're all incredibly macho, honor-focused guys, right? And that has a whole bunch of negative consequences that you don't necessarily want in a fairly settled agricultural world, right? It's a much, agricultural people are much softer and gentler, and that leads to, on balance, a better society, right? So, but anyway, so he's done a whole bunch of interesting work. He did a book called The Geography of Thought, which is all about the differences between how Easterners and Westerners think. And essentially, you know, Easterners have a very sort of holistic way of viewing things, which is a result of rice agriculture, right? Rice agriculture, you can't just sort of focus atomistically on your own little thing. You have to, like, get water from your neighbor, and so you have to think about that relationship. You have to think about all these sorts of things. The Greeks were, you know, very smallholder farmers because Greece is very rocky, and so everybody has their little patch, and you can't be thinking holistically, because if you're thinking holistically, well, you're screwed, because you have to rely entirely on yourself. So this very individualistic way of thinking develops in Greece, which ultimately leads to things like democracy and, you know, debating in the agora and all these sorts of stuff, and is the foundation of Western thought. And ultimately is where science comes from, because science is all about picking out all of the variables, separating them, and thinking of everything as a single strand or a single thread, right? Now, the interesting thing is that, you know, these two different ways of thinking, is it true that individualism is better than thinking, you know, holistically, or that holistic thinking is better than individualism? It's one's not better than the other. They're different approaches, right? You can miss, if you just look at a tree, then you miss the forest. And if you just look at the forest, you don't see the tree.
Sure.
Right. So one of the consequences and one of the most interesting things that came out of that interview is that in Japan, they think that anybody who is overly rational is a bit childish, right? And in the West,
anybody who's overly rational is a bit childish.
Why? Right? Well, in the West, right,
it's the opposite.
Yeah, in the West, we think that reason is the greatest thing in the world and that there's nothing bad to it, right?
Yeah, I would imagine the Japanese are very similar, but they're not.
No, but and it actually makes a whole, and in fact, like if you remember all the behavioral econ people that we've had on, right? So, you know, the Westerners came up with this idea of, like, you know, Homo economicus, that man was a purely rational individual. individual, and we built all our economic models on that, right? But, you know, the reality is that's ridiculous. Human beings are not purely rational agents. We, you know, and this is what Kahneman did, right? We have a whole bunch of intuitions and, you know, all of these prejudices and all that sort of stuff that guide the majority of our thoughts. We don't always necessarily find the best solution and all of that stuff. But the essentially what that, if you focus narrowly on one thing, right, you can literally not see the forest for the trees.
Yes.
And that is sort of that is that childishness that comes from, and you know, there's, can't remember what the article is, but one of the first critiques of sort of the idea of homo economicus.
That makes a lot of sense though, because a child is singularly
focused
right. on, and they don't see the dangers around them.
That's
for example.
Right. Yeah. And so if you look at a lot of what's going on, and this is something that I sort of, you know, you understand in a crude way, and then it all starts to come into focus. If you look at a lot of American politics, there is so much of not seeing the forest for the trees. Everybody identifies their one variable or their one thing and is like, this is the whole picture.
Yeah.
And it's not the whole picture. And part of what we've struggled with is trying to basically start to see the forest, because we talk to this person and it's like, well, what you're talking about is definitely a tree, but I also see this other tree and this other tree and this other tree. And sometimes you need to step back to see that, you know what, if we want to look at the origins of prosperity, right, it's yeah, food is a huge part, like Jared Diamond is right. But also, by the way, Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson are right. Like, you know, social structures, you know, inclusivity, all of these things also make a difference.
Yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, that idea of the rational fool, I think is, you know, like probably the most powerful lens into understanding the sort of the excesses of America and the Western world, mm-hmm. is that there, you know, the ability to separate out a single variable is incredibly, incredibly useful and did lead to science. But it also leads to all of these ridiculous conclusions that don't accurately reflect the reality of the world.
Yeah, that's kind of the reductionist versus mm-hmm. the holistic notion of thinking in some ways, you know,
and it
makes total sense.
Yeah. And I think the challenge is,
but that's also was the sort of the debate between the Darwinians and the romantics. I mean, you know, let's go through the world wondering. You're going to miss a lot.
100%.
You know, you're going to miss a lot if you're, it's William Arnold versus, or Matthew Arnold versus, Aldous Huxley.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the challenge is, and that's, and you know, but even by the same token, right, the romantics can be totally off. Like, we can't just all be wandering around. Like,
sure.
Sometimes we have to pay our bills and we have to, like, grow food and we have to do these practical things. But so the interesting challenge, right, and this is this sort of way of thinking, because this is not something that's taught in school and something you have to find for yourself. But the best first example that I ever found was in Martin Seligman's work, because he talks a lot about, you know, optimism versus pessimism. Right. And in general, optimists in most careers, not all careers, but most careers do better. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, they dream, they aspire, they work hard, they do things that aren't necessarily immediately rational and all that sort of stuff. But pessimists are more realistic.
Well, pessimists are critical in their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important. It's one thing to be an optimist. But, you know, in I think it's in what's it called? Blindsided in Barbara Reinhart.
She
kind of said, look, it's great to be a positive thinker, but it can't get in the way of critical thinking.
Right. But so the point is that it's not, there's so often you hear like these I'm to almost use a terrible word, but these asinine arguments about, like, you know, is optimism better or is pessimism better? But the point is there are two tools.
It's why learning to do something difficult, getting really good at a certain discipline, is so crucial, because you'll understand this anyway. You won't be a purist in one camp or the other.
Mm-hmm.
When you're trying to get really good at something, it does require a lot of singular focus, but it also requires that you broaden your passion and understanding.
Yep.
Because
and you dance between different perspectives.
You have to.
I think
especially as a comic or a writer, a painter,
anything. Yeah. Anything is, and I think that's the point, is that, you know, you can't just be an optimist and you can't just be a pessimist. You have to find that dance between it. You can't just think sort of atomistically in terms of like single variables, and you can't just think holistically, you know. You have to dance between those perspectives, and that's
even fighters, like you'd think they'd have to be really specific, but if you like talk to a fighter, a lot of times, like Brendan gets really mad whenever he sees quick fix solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Lose weight, gain muscle in 30
days. Yeah, yeah.
He's always like, listen, man, I'm a pro athlete. I don't care what you say your diet is. I know what works.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what works as mm-hmm. well. Like he's just like, look, for me,
mm-hmm.
In my experience, you may have this new thing, but in my 20 years of high level sports, this is what I have come to the conclusion of.
Yeah.
And stop coming up with the fact that you've reinvented the wheel.
Right.
You're marketing something. You're
right.
Selling me something.
And so I've been listening to Philip Tetlock's book, Super Forecaster. So Tetlock is
I need a reading list from you.
Well, and vice versa,
yeah.
But I mean,
please.
Yeah. But Tetlock is the guy who really did all the stuff on forecasting, right? And basically found out that most experts are actually terrible forecasters, right? They're horrific at it, right?
But, is that because they have an orthodox way of thinking? They've been thinking a certain way for a long time.
Well,
they don't see the new,
the
black swans.
His big quote is, right? Is I don't know if it's from Aesop's Fables or whatever, but the hedgehog knows one thing, but the fox knows many things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there are a lot of hedgehogs in the world, and you'll find a lot of these guys who have, atomistically focused on one thing, and they're like, this is the truth. This
they're
is the way. And that's right. But inevitably, in the same way as, economists being like, humans are purely rational actors, right? You get blinded to a whole bunch of stuff, right? You don't see the forest for the trees. So the foxes are the people who are often, and if you're an expert, obviously, whatever agenda it is that you're driving, right? Your little piece, your little view of the world, that's your money. That's where your career comes from. That's your brand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're, a pundit on Fox or a pundit on MSNBC or a pundit on anything else, seeing the other side is not going to do much good for you,
right?
And so what ends up happening is that you become blinded to a whole bunch of other things, right? But so they basically, in Super Forecasters, this is obviously hugely important for intelligence,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, how do you predict, will the Soviet Union fall? Will, 9/11 happen? Will all these sorts of things happen? And so they basically, rather than using a bunch of experts, they used actually a bunch of fairly ordinary sort of smart guys who read the New York Times, but like, guys who are, above average in intelligence, but not necessarily, policy experts.
Mm-hmm.
And these non-experts actually end up doing, when you aggregate all of their, 100 of them, they end up doing way, way, way better than all the foreign policy experts in the world. Because they go and they read different sources, they read newspapers, they read books, they read whatever the local newspapers, and then they start to emerge with a picture. And they're individually, they will do, A, they do much better than average, which experts
mm-hmm.
don't, and the experts often do worse than average. But also when you then aggregate it, it may be that this expert has a particular insight to, the economics of Iran, but this one really understands the religion and this one understands this other thing. And so when you aggregate all of their choices, you end up at a fairly good prediction.
Right. That's wild. So you take everything into account.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the point. And I think very often...
But that's always the case. You miss things. I mean, like when Steve Jobs and who else was it? They were so gung-ho on the Segway.
Mm-hmm.
So gung-ho. Problem is they didn't know enough about transportation.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't consulted. They didn't see, then the people that really weren't experts at anything kind of said, well, hold on. If we're going to finance this thing, where do you put groceries? How do you lock it? These are concerns as a woman.
As
a mother, as there are all these issues that, fuck off. Don't worry about that. Let's just put a lot of money into it. And it was an abysmal failure.
Right. But that is...
Because they didn't take into account
that's why you don't want a world run with technocrats, right? Because...
That makes sense.
And inevitably, you end up with a whole bunch of cognitive biases that you don't even realize.
Yeah.
That's intelligence is an emergent property of the crowd. And that's what has happened over the last 100,000 years.
So we need crowds.
Yeah, we need crowds.
No, we need crowds that are allowed to speak their mind.
Yeah, we do. I mean, we can have... But I think that's the thing. That doesn't mean that these things... things can't be done better, you know, and that's really the point. I mean, that's a large part of what we're trying to do here is that ideas don't, technology makes possible the movement of ideas, but they don't overcome groups which prevent the movement of ideas.
That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about, you know, I wish Trump spoke more in terms of ideas. That's not his job, and he's not a guy. He's not a man of ideas. But
no,
and Malice would say he can't do that. And I don't like Trump. I think he's a goddamn buffoon, personally, just off on the record. But and I don't like. You know what I don't like about Trump and Cruz? I think they're mean, and I think they'll say anything to get elected. Well, that's not so. I think not so Cruz. I think Cruz is just a mean guy. I think he's a mean spirited guy. I think he's kind of a bad guy. And I think Trump is a guy, he's a demagogue for sure, but he's also somebody, he's such a narcissist. He'll just do anything.
He 100% is.
He'll just do anything, he'd say anything and do anything to get elected.
Yeah.
Including kill people, probably.
Well, I mean, I don't know. That's definitely possible. I mean,
he's just that much of a narcissist.
I think Cruz is worse than Trump. Like, if
he's a bad guy.
I think he's a bad guy. He's divisive, you know, and he's
not a leader though. When you're a debater, it's not the same as being a leader. If everybody hates you, that's probably not a good. My buddy was like, "I want Washington to hate our leader." Well, okay, great, but. It's just, I don't know if anybody likes
that. Wait a minute, so this is a buddy who is pro-Cruz?
Yeah, he's a Wall Street guy, bond trader, it doesn't matter.
Oh, that's...
He hates himself too, though, so...
Well, that's probably not good.
What is your take on these elections, and who do you think is going to win?
Well, I don't know who's...
My father would say there's no way Trump is going to win.
Unfortunately, I don't know that that's true. Yeah. I mean, so I had... I had dinner a couple of months ago with the guy who's a senior Bush staffer. And, you know, back then, and this was like in October or whatever, he's like, oh, you know, Trump, like Trump will drop out, like he'll drop out. I mean, you know, I hope he'll have the good sense and the good grace to drop out before the end of the year, but he'll certainly drop out before Iowa because he knows that this isn't going anywhere and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, so many people have wanted to believe that Trump will like stop and then, you know, this will evolve into a thing that he can then go write books off of. I don't think so. I think that's the point. I mean, you know, he's going to run this thing as long as
Well, let's see. I want to see when we get into these. I mean, when we really get into these.
But like who I mean, but the real question, right, is if
well,
not.
Well, by the way, if not Trump, who? Right?
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah, I'm not voting for Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think there's
I mean, I'd probably rather vote for Sanders maybe than Hillary.
I would definitely vote for Sanders over Hillary.
But I probably wouldn't actually because Hillary feels like just more of the same, and I think we're so far doing okay. I don't think she'd be as disruptive. See, I'm looking for a candidate who's not going to be disruptive, and I think Hillary Clinton. I don't think Hillary Clinton's evil, and I don't think she. I think she genuinely wants to solve problems. I think she knows how to work with people. I think she's smart. I don't think she's that left wing. I think she's moderate.
No, I agree with you. I think that Hillary Clinton will mostly be treading water presidency, which. You know, but I think anyway, regardless, there's the question of who wins the Republican nomination, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's Trump. I don't think Cruz is going to win the Republican nomination.
Kasich, maybe. Huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's
old
well, there's
looks
the
like your boss.
There's a fantasy that like, yeah, some sort of establishment candidate is going to rise to the front. But I think what Bernie Sanders and Trump represent is people are fed up with the establishment. Yeah. And I don't know that any establishment candidate is going to get the nomination.
Boy, oh boy.
I mean, we may have Brian, you may be faced with the choice of Trump versus Sanders for president of the United States.
Even over, do you think Sanders could get the nomination over Hillary?
Well, I agree with Michael Malice and everybody else who said that, you know, the DNC
won't let it happen.
The DNC will do everything in their power to make sure that it doesn't happen.
How can they do that, though?
In the same way that the RNC will do everything in their power to make sure that Trump doesn't win. But I think that's the problem is that both of the parties have so mismanaged everything for the last few decades and have alienated their
people
so much.
Well, it's also, they're probably, people calling shots probably a little older and not as savvy with social media and don't have
100%. Well, they tried to control with, you know, I mean, it was clear that Hillary Clinton was the anointed one back in 2008 and then Obama came along.
That's true. They switch gears real quick.
And I think it'll be
which could happen with Sanders, but good luck with that.
Well, but that's
he's not terribly presidential, but you know, I do like the guy. I
think
he's a good man.
Yeah.
But he said, I just don't agree with him. Ladies and gentlemen, that's been that's pretty much been our time here.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, I just want to say on behalf of the community that it's an honor to have Brian Callen on the Brian Callen Show.
Go on. I'm so happy. It's nice to be here. I got to go solve some problems now creatively for
this
TV show I'm doing. Thanks, everybody, for listening, man. I very much appreciate it.
Brian, where can
it's always a learning experience with you.
Where can people see you next?
I don't know when we're going to air this. When are we gonna
I don't know, but they should. But you can bet that wherever they can see you, they should go see. They
go
should
to tfatk.com.
That's right.
Tfatk.
Tfatk.
Tfatk.com for my tour schedule.
Yeah, and to buy merchandise.
Stands for, no, we don't sell, well, only when we drop the shirts. We sold out of our sweatshirts yesterday
in about
30 minutes. Yeah.
Were those shirts, let me ask you this, because I don't know whether I'm just super old, but soft is like,
soft.
They're so soft.
Yeah.
Like, how soft?
Like if you were to pet the underbelly of a baby beaver while it's still in its mother's womb.
Wow. So it's soft and wet.
We make them from wet, soft beaver fetus.
What?
Yeah, it's expensive. It's expensive and really cruel. But it's worth it to us.
Yeah, totally.
To give the people what they want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well,
your skin should feel good, and fuck beavers. That's the motto. That's our caption.
I mean, fuck beavers would not be a bad caption.
Let your skin feel good and fuck beavers.
You guys should make that. I think that'd be a great Fighter and the Kid t-shirt. Fuck beavers.
We're thinking about it.
Yeah.
All right, kids.
All right. Thanks so much, Brian.
You're the best.
You're the best.
No, you're the best.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.